forms of life, only to discover that someone had already been working through it in a much more nuanced and profound way. So that was my first encounter with David's work. A brief moment of ego deflation, I'll admit. But also great excitement in reading a then unpublished paper he generously sent by email for the book I have here in my hands, The Power of Life, A Gammon and the Coming Politics. So this is already the second book in sort of trilogy, Forms of Life trilogy, with Wittgenstein's Forms of Life published by Continuum in 2008 as the first, and the third one is on the way soon, so I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it. He's also worked as a translator or co-translator on Agamben's Nudities and What is an Apparatus. And in another brief note, I think you're hosting an event soon at the ICI. There's information here, Critique of Pure Movement, so feel free to pick that up. It's on the 7th of May.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's about dance.
Dance and philosophy, or just...
Yes.
Okay. Choreographing the writing aspects. Okay. So I could go on, but I'd rather give the floor over to you. You're all here to hear David. So let me just close by stating my particular interest in your work. So the particular way forms of life seem to be able to negotiate, at least in your reading of it, seem to be able to negotiate the everyday and the event, the polarities of which are often held at a distance in philosophical discourse. So the importance and expansiveness of the forms of life inquiry at the heart of your work, and I'll paraphrase you here, is that a form of life constitutes the center of a triangle whose three points, and I would add edges, are made up of political action, philosophical thought, and ethics. The form of life is nothing less than a way of being, and that way of being is a form of power. So with that said, I'd like to give you the floor, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you all for coming. Now I'm working on this book that is basically a crazy sequel to the Arcades project by Walter Benjamin, which is called, as a joke, the Manhattan Project. So instead of being about Paris as the capital of the 19th century, it's about New York as the capital of the 20th century. So in that sense, it's a kind of a sequel. And that will be called actually Sheer Life, because Benjamin says in the Arcades that the city is a landscape built of sheer life. So in a way, I move somehow from talking about a form of life to talk about sheer life, maybe. And today, just because I knew that I'm going to talk in a gallery, and after talking with Patricia about it, I really don't want to talk specifically about forms of life, but about precisely the relationship between philosophy and art, which in a way relates to this talk about dance and philosophy, more specifically. So then I came up with this stupid title, How many philosophers does it take to unscrew an artist? Right?
Vice versa.
How many artists does it take to unscrew a philosopher? Sorry. And the vice versa does not mean, as some people claim, how many artists does it take to screw a philosopher. It's not my intention. Okay? And it's none of your business. Also. But the opposite, I think, is actually more relevant today, which is how many philosophers does it take to unscrew an artist. But it really depends who you are, if you are an artist or a philosopher. And it will be interesting to think where exactly we stand in relationship to those two types, basically. So I'll read something for half of the time, and then we'll talk, right, till now?
Sure.
Okay. So, in Christianity, God's work is called Opus Dei. In Judaism, the work of God is called Melechet Hashem. In Islam, it is called Sunnah. Of course, the monotheistic God is such a big shot that he doesn't need to personally toil and sweat by doing stuff. Instead, he outsources this work to others. In the Islamic tradition, the divine praxis can be divided into two categories. The first is the work of creation, And the second one is the walk of salvation. Angels are above all responsible for this walk of creation, while prophets are those in charge of the walk of salvation. Angels are to God what elves are to Santa Claus. They make the toys he gets credit for. The prophet, by contrast, is the mediator of salvation. His prime relation is not to God, but to the world. The prophet's place in the world is like the place of Elijah's cup in the Passover meal. The participants are required to drink 4 cups of wine in the course of this dinner, which for us is kind of a big deal. But then there is a 5th, special, fancy cup that we save for Elijah, filled to the brim, untouched by the participants, who await with the front door open for the arrival of its otherworldly drinker. In an essay called Creation and Salvation, Giorgio Agamben, who does stand at the center of this talk today, muses about the interesting fact that in the Islamic tradition, the prophetic walk of salvation is not only more important than the angelic walk of creation, but even precedes it chronologically. I'm sure you all know that Muhammad is not an angel, but the prophet par excellence. In Islam, the demand for reparation, for justice, for righting a wrong, somehow comes before the wrongdoings that plague the created world. This is like saying that when you hold in the morning a cup of coffee, you have this urge to glue the handle back on even before you broke it. Agamben sees nothing wrong with creativity, with making things, with new beginnings, with being productive, with being the kind of doer who is always looking ahead. But he also believes that it is as important, or actually more important, to be able to salvage, to undo, to redeem, to retrieve, to complete, and even arrest this progression, this mad progression of time. You might think that the walk of creation is energetic and optimistic, while the walk of salvation is more lethargic and melancholic. But Agamben insists that the prophetic element in our lives could be and should be as tireless and as vivacious as the angelic one. From this perspective, it seems that the answer to the walking class is not at all the creative class, but rather the saving class. The saving class, however, should be distinguished from bohemianism or hipsterism. It doesn't have much to do with telling everyone you know about the short story collection you are working on, with or without actually getting paid for it, or actually writing it, like Hannah from the TV show Girls. It also has little to do with the defeatist resignation in view of the world, this feeling that everything sucks and everyone is an idiot, like Ray in Girls. And it has certainly nothing to do with this privileged sense of still being unsure about how to actualize your potentiality, maybe as a curator, maybe as a singer, like the Money from Girls. Agamben is yet to watch a single episode of Girls, even though Zizek sent him the DVDs of the entire first season. For Agamben, the saving class includes those persons who clean the mess others left behind, those who mend what others broke, those who contemplate what the others blather with such confidence. This is exactly how Walter Benjamin thinks about his own work when he claims that he doesn't want to make an inventory of the rags and the refuse of the past, but simply allow them to come into their own by making use of them in his own philosophy. When Agamben looks at the modern world of art and technology, he seems to conceive it as a single sphere inhabited by creative angels. When he looks at the modern world of philosophy and criticism, what he sees is another, separate, unified sphere dedicated to redemptive prophets. The big problem for him is that today, these two worlds become oblivious to each other's existence. The makers lost touch with the savers. I wonder whether Agamben would have made this argument if he was more familiar with the incestuous relationship between art and theory in the contemporary Berlin scene, like the one that is happening right now in this room. But I also think that he makes a good point when he observes that today the angel and the prophet tend to switch places. Think, for example, of how critics transform into curators, who then take the place of artists by simulating the work of creation, by imagining that pointing at things is more creative and more important than the things themselves. At the same time, one can argue that the main reason young artisans get so excited these days about their artisanal vocation as makers or creators, is because they try to become the savers or redeemers of these obsolete types of work, which they then sell in boutiques or on Etsy with price tags that the true working class can never afford. So how are we to make sense of the relationship between those critical prophets who call themselves philosophers and those inspired angels who call themselves artists? Was I supposed to do this with irony? I'm not sure. I guess. How can we unscrew rather than screw each other? To answer these questions, we first need to figure out why are we even attracted to one another? The usual way to answer this question is to look for the content of the other's work, to figure out what the theory or what the art is about. Personally, I find this practice to be highly suspect and rarely helpful. Most of the time, the artist only flattens the theoretical achievement, and the theorist only flattens the artistic achievement. Most of the time, they bog each other down. Notice, by the way, that if the artistic example used in theory book is not already canonical, it is more often than not in bad taste. For example, I'm sure you know that this famous photo from National Geographic cover of this young Afghan girl with the green eyes and the red scarf, right? So Agamben actually has this little picture next to his desk and even wrote about it in one of his essays. Just an example. There is a much better but also more elusive way to think about the relationship between artists and philosophers. So let's stop thinking for a second about the content of the critical work or the artistic work and think instead about the form. Simple. Agamben suggests that when this is done right, when the work of creation and the work of salvation make use of, rather than abuse, the formal elements embedded in each other, what we get is something that he calls style. Style is a kind of signature. But this signature does not denote the singularity of the painter or the writer. Style is not a marker of my own unique voice. Rather, style denotes something that does not belong to me. It is actually the foreign element in my own work. It is a counterforce to my own force. Style is the trace of the creative in the critical, or the trace of the critical in the creative. Personally, I feel that if I have even a shred of style when I write, then it definitely did not come from reading critical or philosophical works, but from encounters with creative or poetic works. Many of them are not even verbal. Now, I don't want to give a counterexample of how style can come to an artist following an involvement with theory, because I'm sure that, as a philosopher, it will again be in bad taste. Yeah. So in the remainder of my time today, I want to talk about Agamben's own singular style, rather than about what his philosophy is about, because I believe that this is how we can be most, in what way he can be most relevant for artists and art makers today. So above all, I should say that Agamben's thought is not searching for a definitive metaphysical ground or a static essence. Instead, he gives us different means, which themselves lack a fixed end. His philosophical practice is always dedicated to the discovery of something that he likes to call means without end. So his own work can be described as an attempt to make means meet, like make ends meet. So make means meet, but I don't mean that the means meet their end, but I mean that the means meet one another. Right? His texts can therefore be read as constellations of very different elements that crystallize into gestures. Gestures are different from propositions. When people say something stupid, we usually don't just tell them how stupid they are. Instead, we roll our eyes. In the same way, certain philosophical works, like Agamben's The Common Community, which I always think that this is the first book that, if you want to read Agamben, that's usually the best way to start, as far as I'm concerned. So the thing about these kind of philosophical books is that they cannot be reduced to propositions or theses about how things are or how they should be or how they shouldn't be. This text, like so many other texts, is much better understood if we think about them as gestures. It is true that Agamben engages only in theory, but I think that his philosophy is a good example of the way theoretical work can have a real effect in this world. At the same time, notice how so many actions in the real world that people believe that they should undertake can be rather impractical and totally ineffective. People are surprised when I talk about Agamben as a pragmatist, but I'm convinced that he is very attentive to precisely what the text can do. Although he avoids the question, what shall we do? Because he thinks that this is a pretty empty question that usually leads to paralysis instead of to action, he is always drawn to form more focused questions that can lead to more concrete answers about how to do and think about certain things, or how to act and be in certain situations. But of course, the possibilities implied in his philosophy are never sealed off from future interpretations or appropriations. So, this priority of the how over the what in Agamben's work means, above all, that the question, what is philosophy, moves into the less obvious, how is philosophy. Here lies what, for me at least, is his most enduring legacy. Not what he thinks, but how he thinks. The fact that he never bothered to give this how a catchy name should not deceive you. He is not committing himself to one of the available restrictive readings that we impose upon the world, like Marxist, postcolonialist, poststructuralist, psychoanalytic, deconstructionist, feminist, and the list goes on, but not indefinitely. Agamben is also not in the business of indoctrinating his readers into a new school of thought or a new ism. Still, I'm pretty sure that his work has some, to also represent an important shift in the way we do theory today. But in what way? We normally like to call these questions or those considerations the method of the philosopher. But since the word method comes from odos, which in Greek means way, we can also speak about the way of the philosopher, you know, like the way of the samurai, something like that. The problem here is that methodological discussions tend to give the impression, as Heidegger once put it, of people sharpening knives when there is nothing left to cut. So I'm sorry if what I have to say today sounds a little bit like sectarian knife sharpening. I do it only because I believe that today there is actually so much that still needs to be cut. Philosophers like to see themselves either as builders or as demolishers. The most ambitious ones tend to think that they can do both, whereas the slightly more modest ones try to engage in the necessary side work associated with this ever-evolving and often lucrative real estate enterprise. Let's think again about Walter Benjamin, who had such a huge impact on Agamben's work. The difficulty that people still have in accepting someone like Benjamin as a real philosopher has a lot to do with the fact that this game of destruction and construction and deconstruction is at a complete stalemate in his work. The dialectics in both Benjamin and Agamben is always at a standstill. Like Agamben, Benjamin is not dismantling anything and he's not assembling anything. Instead, I like to imagine him wandering across a land scattered with ruins. By attending to the remains of our industrious tradition, to the fragments of our intellectual culture, he redeems those obscure elements from their perpetual exchange in the marketplace of ideas. By finding a new use for old ideas within the context of his own work, he seems to grant them kind of an afterlife. But the thing is that what is much less apparent, though much more important about Benjamin's method, is that the condition of survival, which I mean here in the etymological sense of outliving, overliving, hyperliving, or a posthumous existence, has to do with the philosopher before it even applies to the elements of his philosophy. The remnant that is here at stake is not only an item that belonged to a bygone historical age and was then salvaged by the retrothinker in the present one. You know those solitary characters in science fiction movies, like Will Smith in I Am Legend or Wall-E in Wall-E? They confront the remains of their own civilization after its apocalyptic extinction. In the same way, I believe that it is the philosopher, and not just his philosophy, that should assume today the role of the remnant. Though Agamben is clearly indebted to this Benjaminian method, he also departs from his teacher in at least one intriguing way. Benjamin's texts, for me at least, tend to twist, curl, convolute, and turn back upon themselves. They feel like labyrinths with many entrances, but not discernible exits. They're like this Kafka story about the animal that digs in the ground a shelter that gets so elaborate that it turns into a trap. Though Benjamin's work is explicitly meant to lead the reader to his awakening, it usually gives the impression of a dreamscape, not of an alarm clock, as he sometimes claimed that it should be. But not always, of course. For instance, his last essay on the concept of history is a decisive exception, but maybe that was too late. In Agamben, by contrast, the rubble in which the philosopher wanders tends to lose its weight, which enables him to somehow let go of the burden of its heavy past. This allows his prose not exactly to soar, but in a sense, to levitate slightly above the wasteland of tradition. It is not uncommon for writers to get buried under the text that they analyze. Even what Agamben once called the deconstructionist factory, which promised to destabilize the foundational text of our culture, more often than not just left the readers ensnared by those texts. By contrast, one of the things that Agamben's work can teach us is that to master a text means not only that you know it inside out, but even more decisively, that the interpreter does not end up being enslaved by the text that is being interpreted. You can hear an echo of this line of thought in one of Ingeborg Bachmann's posthumously published poems. And maybe you know that Bachmann was a good friend of Agamben in the late 70s, I think, until she decided that smoking in bed was a good idea. Never mind. So it's just four lines. I'm going to read it and I'm going to read it again. The radical means wasteland, but only to the eye that serves life. Feather light rubble. Again. The radical means wasteland, but only to the eye that serves life. Feather light rubble. Let's unpack this. First, to be radical is to treat life as something that you master, not something that you serve. So to be a radical thinker is not to see the debris that piles up with the progress of history as if it is a heavy and depressing apocalyptic wasteland. For the radical thinker, this debris becomes as light as a page in a book. The rubble is feather light. To make more sense of this gesture, let's think of another major promoter of the value of lightness, who was also a good friend of Agamben. Italo Calvino died not while smoking in bed, but while he was preparing the Norton lectures for Harvard. From his notes, he really died as he was making them, or writing them. From his notes, which were published after his death as six memos for the next millennium, we know that he intended to devote the opening lecture to this subject of lightness. One of his leading claims there is that, in opposition to what someone like Zizek may lead you to believe, lightness need not collapse into frivolity, that it is possible to imagine what Calvino calls a thoughtful lightness. What is thoughtful lightness? In his undelivered lecture, there is a paragraph that reads as either a prophecy or a will. Sorry again, I'm quoting. Were I to choose an auspicious image for the new millennium, I would choose that one. The sudden, agile leap of the poet-philosopher, who raises himself above the weight of the world, showing that with all his gravity, he has the secret of lightness, and that what many consider to be the vitality of the times, noisy, aggressive, revving and roaring, belongs to the realm of death, like a cemetery for rusty cars, end quote. As was the case with Bachmann's poem, let's assume that when Calvino talks about the poet-philosopher, he's literally giving us here a description of Agamben. But that's not my point. What Calvino is trying to do here is to distance his position from the one promoted around the same time, it's like the early 80s, 84, something like that, by Milan Kundera in The Unbearable Lightness of Being. For Kundera, nothing is consequential and everything is permitted because life is lighter than air, you know, 80s postmodernism. By contrast, Calvino repeatedly evokes the heaviness of life and the world in which we live. Then he presents the kind of literature that adheres to the secret of lightness as a way to somehow balance out the heaviness of this world and this life, to keep us floating. In this way, he invites a pretty problematic dichotomy between weightless writing as opposed to weighty living. You know, Nietzsche 101. But my claim is that there is something about Agamben's own poetic philosophy that can teach us how to approach both what is written and what is lived, both language and the world, with a kind of lightness that ends up being both bearable and thoughtful. How? Agamben claims that philosophical prose must be poeticized. He actually stole this line from Wittgenstein. So philosophy must be poeticized, or else it runs the risk of falling into banality, of lacking thought. But the thing is that without lightness, it is very difficult to be thoughtful. This can be explained by observing the mosaic-like nature of Agamben's work. The little stones that make up his texts are fragments chiseled from larger stones or text written by others. If you are into this kind of stuff, you can think of it as a historical materialism, but not in the sense of a historical analysis directed at material processes, but in the sense of a philosophical process that uses history as its material, even as its capital, in an attempt to win over history itself by going against its grain. The resulting mosaic, however, is not a jigsaw puzzle, where simply putting the pieces in the right place reveals a hidden, preordained picture. Let's start by calling this method détournement, this cutting, pasting, and altering of found materials in the process of creating a new work. The best example of this method is naturally Guy Debord's films, like The Society of the Spectacle from 1973, which are made up of a montage of seemingly unrelated available images, like commercials, newsreels, Hollywood films, pornographic images, etc. I say naturally because the French word détournement is used by Debord himself, who, by the way, was also a friend of Agamben. On his part, Agamben is appropriating what seems at times to be a bottomless stockpile of references, which he rummaged from the archives of our tradition. In this way, he performs what could be called the philosophical détournement. If history is still understood as a train ride, then we can also call Agamben's method historical derailment. Agamben's texts offer different paths for potential struggles. He knows that an effective strategy of resistance can no longer be restricted to a single plane of thought or action. Instead, it must branch out and operate in a thousand plateaus, to use Deleuze and Guattari's lingo. Agamben's work, however, remains decidedly confined to the creation of philological or linguistic plateaus. Whereas a visual artist can use any sort of material, a writer has only sentences, which Agamben treats at times as if they were what artists call found objects. The favorite tools of the critical trade are quotations. Benjamin claims that quotes are like armed thieves who leap at the readers when they least expect it, in order to steal their convictions. The big problem, again, is that when writers misuse this tool, it is they, not the readers, who end up getting robbed of their own convictions. Agamben can usually avoid this trap because he is a philologist in the same way that Foucault is a historian. A citation, like the whole of the Western tradition, is not considered by Agamben to be authoritative. and he does not see himself as its heir. When he uses a quote, he always takes it out of context, in the simple sense that he places it in the new context of his own philosophy. Even though he never denies that the Western tradition is the very air that he breathes, he is not merely trying to evoke it, or conform to it, or oppose it, or destroy it. Instead, his books are basically meant to make the tradition. I'll get back to this. Though he often produces pretty systematic scholarly studies, Agamben also likes to assemble what appears to be miniature sketches or images or scenes. Each one of them can stand still and stand alone. When he collects these little vignettes into a monograph, they sometimes resemble one of those flip books, you know, that you, with your finger and your thumb, you know.
Daumen-Kino.
What?
Daumen-Kino.
That's how they're called?
Yeah, in German, yeah.
Okay, good. I learned something. But the thing, though, is that they don't move. The picture doesn't move. It stands still. But we get the illusion of movement. The thing is that Agamben's thought does not pretend to lead us from point A to point B by means of an argumentative apparatus. Think about the ladder. Agamben offers us the rungs, but they are not affixed to the two sidebars that make the ladder, on which we could comfortably ascend or descend. Another way to understand Agamben's philosophical practice is to approach it as a bricolage. The French word bricolage is close to what in English we call do-it-yourself, right? In The Savage Mind, Claude Lévi-Strauss described the bricoleur as an amateur handyman who is very different from the engineer. So what is the difference between a bricoleur and the engineer? If I'm a bricoleur, then I improvise with whatever is at hand. If I'm an engineer, then I specialize in a defined field which demands the availability of certain tools and certain raw materials. The engineer is always trying to go beyond the constraints imposed by the particular state of civilization. The bricoleur, by contrast, prefers to play with the strictures of his situation. If the engineer completes a project according to a plan and moved on to the next, the bricoleur does not necessarily complete anything, although he always puts something of himself into what he does. But the motivation that leads Lévi-Strauss to make the distinction between the bricoleur and the engineer is not restricted to the technical sphere. Bricolage is his way of introducing a way of thinking that he calls the science of the concrete. And despite what the title of the book may imply, Lévi-Strauss is not only interested here in the exotic minds of isolated savages. It is no surprise, then, that since the publication of The Savage Mind, bricolage and DIY have been used as models for new creative processes shared by many contemporary artists. Even though the term is not to be found in Benjamin's Arcades project or Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigation, I always think that the practice of bricolage seem to be at play in these two unfinished masterpieces. It is only in Derrida and Deleuze that the method of philosophical bricolage is mentioned explicitly, though fleetingly. My claim is that Agamben's work is an interesting example of a thinker or a tinkerer who consciously employs this Lévi-Straussian science of the concrete as a basic tool in his philosophical practice. There is a hilarious account of the spirit of bricolage in an essay called The Ideal of the Broken, or Kaputten, you know, in German, which was published in 1926 by Alfred Sonreter. This short piece revolves around the city of Naples. Almost everything in Naples, Sonreter observes, is broken. This is because the Neapolitans prefer to begin using their devices only after they break down and lose their original purpose. In Naples, an intact mechanism is seen as deeply uncanny and is approached with great suspicion. A new machine first needs to be misused, then to malfunction, then to be fixed or altered in a makeshift way, and then, only then, can it really start to work. One of his examples is that he went to a dairy shop and he saw this machine to whip the cream, and it was really made from like a motorbike or some Vespa's motor that was reused to be to the crane in that shop. Notice, by the way, that this is a curious reversal of Martin Heidegger's famous argument. In Being and Time, Heidegger teaches us that we don't notice the doorknob we turn on a daily basis until it breaks. But the Neapolitans consider the moment the thing malfunctions as the moment when it can finally be used. Okay? Usually, we just turn the knob and it's ready to hand, right? What Heidegger calls ready to hand. But then it breaks and then we notice it as present at hand. The Neapolitans actually do the exact opposite, according to Somrete. When something breaks, that's actually when they can start using it for the first time as ready to hand. But by the way, Somrete also reports that doors are rarely left shut in Naples, and doorknobs are usually treated as mere ornaments. Again, that's what he says. Here we can find a unique answer to the question concerning technology. Somrete concludes that the true essence of technology is in making that which is broken to function in unforeseen ways. By handling defunct mechanisms, the Neapolitans become the true sovereigns of technology, because they figured out a way to oppose the blind and hostile automatism of the machines. In Naples, it becomes very difficult to distinguish between use and misuse, between function and malfunction, between proper and improper. So to begin to conclude, I still need to explain what is the significance of all these observations when we shift the focus from the technical plane to the intellectual one, from making to saving. Here is how. 2 centuries before Somrete, Giambattista Vico, who was a Neapolitan by birth and by death, became deeply dissatisfied with the Cartesian school of thought that dominated the intellectual circles in which he moved. In a book called On the Most Ancient Wisdom of the Italians, Vico claims that what those dogmatic followers of Descartes are lacking is something that in Latin is called ingenium, which is normally translated as ingenuity or inventiveness or mother wit or even cunning. Without ingenium, a philosopher may still be considered a decent craftsman or a good engineer, but nothing more. Vico's complaint is that the geometrical method deployed in the production of the typical philosophical tracts of his time, it's like the early 18th century, would make a person go what he called rational madness. You will go rationally mad, especially when you try to apply Descartes' theoretical method to everyday life. But this is far from being a superfluous criticism of a disgruntled thinker. Vico takes the notion of ingenium very seriously. He defines it as the faculty that connects different things. Okay, ingenium is defined as the faculty that connects different things. And then he also claims that imagination is in this sense the eye of ingenium. For example, those who lack ingenium are absolutely blind to metaphors, similes, analogies, illustrations, allegories, and associations, which may not be the bread of philosophy, but they are certainly its butter. For Descartes, the big question, and that's actually an important point, for Descartes, the big question is how we discover the truth by using our reason, right? For Vico, by contrast, the big question is how we make the truth by using our ingenium. This, in a nutshell, is his famous equation of verum and factum, his insistence that the true is something that we make, something that we constantly create. Agamben reminds us that ingenium is closely linked to the word genius. But what is genius exactly? For the ancient Romans, genius was the name of a special god who is born together with each and every human being. For the Romans, when you were born, there was another god that was born together with you. It was your personal god. His name was Genius. And he followed you wherever you go. So birthday parties were really originally, I mean, what we call today birthday parties are profane versions of sacred rituals that the Romans celebrated not for you. It wasn't for the birthday boy. it was for genius. You gave gifts to this genius. You celebrated him, not you. But even though genius is your own personal God, it is still not exactly yourself. It is instead an alterity of sorts. Agamben explains that genius is your life only insofar as this life does not belong to you. Genius watches over you and you alone, but he is different than you. In this way, Agamben can place the ego of a person on one side while positioning genius on the opposite, impersonal side. He claims that these two forces always coexist and intersect with one another, but that neither can ever emancipate itself completely from the other side. There is no ego without genius, and there is no genius without ego. For Agamben, ego and genius constitute the polar opposition of each and every human being. In the middle of this field of forces, he locates this thing that we call the subject. The subject needs to constantly negotiate its position in relation to these two opposing forces that we call ego and genius. This piece of information allows us to go back and see in a new light Vico's hostility towards what he considered to be the Cartesians of the letter, not of the spirit. Those Cartesians controlled the philosophical discourse of his time. But the problem was that these Cartesians wanted to ground their philosophy only on that which firmly belonged to them. This is to say, the absolute certainty in their ego's existence, right? But they failed to listen to their genius. They totally forgot about their genius. But unlike these watered-down Cartesians, Descartes himself never ignored the element in his life that did not belong to him. This is already clear from his first major work, which is called in Latin, Regula et Directionem Ingenii. The generic translation to English is Rules for the Directions of the Mind, right? In French, we say Ingenii is usually translated as Esprit. But these translations completely miss the point that the ultimate concern of Descartes' book is to find a way to direct or calibrate our ingenium, to figure out a method to cope with this genius. It is also not a coincidence that in the first meditation, Descartes calls his grand deceiver genium aliquem malignum. This is his famous evil genius, right? Maybe you remember that he distinguishes the evil genius, this deceptive genius, from the benevolent God, who would never dare to trick him. Descartes follows here a long-standing tradition that splits the single genius of the Romans into a good genius and a bad genius, into these two personal gods that sit on my shoulder and push me either to salvation or to damnation. One last one. So to really conclude, let's apply Agamben's approach to Descartes' thought. Let's return to this first split between genius as one pole and ego as its opposite pole. From this perspective, I don't think that we can hold on anymore to this Archimedean point of modern philosophy, this immobile, static, ego sum, this certainty that I exist, which is how we usually read Descartes. I think that now we can see that even the father of modern philosophy was actually already operating in this field of tensions, in this zone of indetermination between genius and ego, between ingenium and reason, between creation and salvation. Thank you.
So does anyone have any questions? Or you need a few minutes?
Please.
No, I just think it's interesting because this word genius, I mean, I don't know if you're aware, it's kind of like no one would dare utter this word in art theory anymore, yet it's still so absolutely pervasive in the whole logistics of the market. But it's quite they're referring more to, say, what I would say, like a conscience genius. That whole thing has been sort of overturned, at least theoretically, but I think the imaginary of this conscient genius still hovers over in the sense of the exclusive one who can create. But there was some points I was wondering if you could link.
But for me, I mean, for Gamelin, it seems that genius is not some marker that is given to, you know, special artists that make billions of dollars.
No, you said everyone's born
everyone.
With.
Yeah. It's totally, yeah.
In the...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, in the Kantian way, this is absolutely not the case, obviously. And that sort of exclusive or exceptional state, if you want to even put it in a Gamelin's terms, is often what... I would say, like...
Yeah, the genius is not
in
the sovereignty.
Theory, everyone,
Yeah, there's no sovereignty in the genius.
In this notion of the genius,
right.
Yeah.
Nice, yeah, interesting.
Mm.
Never thought about this.
But I was wondering, because the kind of term use kept coming up, especially at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's also been kind of a present term lately as well. I'm just thinking back to former West when someone like Tania Bulgera is arguing for useful art, and then there's a whole other camp that's very much an antagonism to this. And for me, this, I always ask myself, I'm thinking about the profanation text, where he's talking about a return to use and critiquing even the third level beyond the Marxist sort of use value, etc., to this third level exhibition value. And I've always been confused where Agamben stands on that, because my perception as an artist is that exhibition value is another type of use.
Huh.
It's an affective use.
Well, I mean, exchange value goes back. I mean, this is Benjamin in the art essay, right?
Mm-hmm.
He will
talk
about.
But like, then,
right.
Agamben riffs on that in
right.
the profanation text, jumping
okay.
to the third term. And I'm just curious,
uh-huh.
like, as a kind of Agamben scholar, where do you stand on that? Is an exhibition value another type of use value?
I mean, first of all, in relation to profanations, I think that what I was trying to do here is to say that, I mean, the tradition, there's nothing sacred about the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the use that I'm interested in here is less the use of the philosophy for other means that are not philosophy. It's more about the fact that there are all these texts, and what is the relationship that we have to that tradition that we call the Western tradition, or whatever it is that you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we deconstruct it? Do we beheld it by this tradition? What is that relationship? And in a way, in Agamben, there is precisely that type of profanation of that relationship that we have with this text by the mere way by which he will use it in his own philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's just a suggestion for the way other people may want to do it as well. Yeah, exhibition value, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to talk about relational aesthetics or something like that, but I don't, but specifically the very moment in which, you know, yeah, an object is just there and we cannot touch it as we can touch those piles of paper,
mm-hmm.
and then there is, you know, we reify it and we fetishize it and eventually it becomes a spectacle. This is to say it's abstracted from the sphere of everyday use,
mm-hmm.
then we lose it. And then I wonder, you know, yeah, how can that be
descriptive?
Yeah. How can bring it back?
Yeah.
I was wondering, thanks for the talk, first of all. I was wondering, you said a few things about Agamben, his writing, and also that he produces like vignettes or images, or the gestures that are important, or how he thinks about style is something heteronomous or so to him. But then, so that's one thing you did. But then you try to you explain the kind of practice of his philosophical or his philosophy. But what you did with him was a rather, I would say, like hermeneutical approach. So you tried to explain him. So that's like part of my question is like whether there's a certain tension in that. And then because some things you said like reminded me, especially the first part, that in Agamben there's a distinction. At one point he distinguishes like poesis and praxis, you know, and that could be very important like for this context or what you were interested
right.
in. Art and Agamben or aesthetics and Agamben, because what he says is that the whole aesthetical tradition or modernity and so on has developed on a understanding of these two terms that is completely contrary to how the Greeks initially understood it. So for us, practice means like it is related to a certain experience and to a certain production. Whereas he tries to show that for the Greeks it had a very different meaning, you know, that poetics is not at all something just about writing, but is something like a production of truth, like producing truth in the way a bit like you were talking about Vinco. So that's not in the way of a genius, but really like in the way of producing a truth in a Heideggerian way. So I would just sorry for this long absurd question, but like I think it's there where he could be really really interesting, you know, to show that in the way how he does philosophy in his poetics in his writing, you know, he explains us something about like a different understanding of production that is not just a philosophical, not just a literary or artistic one, but it might be one that is not aesthetically, but.
Right. I mean, specifically on the aesthetic, because I mean, most of what you were saying in the second part comes from The Man Without Content, and there, that's precisely the argument, and it starts really nicely. Actually, we don't even need to go back to the Greeks. I mean, it really starts with this tension between Nietzsche and Kant, and his claim is that with Kant, you start treating art as aesthesis, as merely that. The sensation of the viewer rather than the hand that makes the art of the artist, blah blah blah, which goes back to this question of presentation or exhibition value, and then he will go on to speak precisely about poesis as this, how close we are to that origin and the distance that we have from that origin. So that's, I mean, if you really want to get kind of like his most definitive way of thinking about these questions, this is his first book, which he wrote when he was very young in 1970, and he's not really like buying this book anymore, but it's interesting to see the connection between this and that. To what you first said, I just think that, I mean, what I was doing in this chapter was, right, I always have that question of, you know, when you write about something, do you emulate the style or you try to do something else? And it's, you can fall into both traps, basically. But what I was trying to do here, and I took a lot of parts because this is from one of the chapters in the book, is to, again, talk about Agamben, but talk about him from all these other writers, through all these other writers that he never even mentioned. Or, for instance, the poem by Bachmann, or Calvino, and then Vico, and then Descartes, and then Levi Strauss, and then Sonnretel. So in that way, I was actually trying to create that kind of montage. There is one section that I took out just before I got here, in which Agamben talks about, in 1985, he published this book called The Idea of Prose, which is the most kind of like definitive fragmentary text that he ever wrote. And there was an interview just after the publication in which he says that he wants to think about philosophy as a type of brachylogy. And he doesn't say anything about it. What does it mean? But brachylogy, to those who don't know, means basically short speech. Brachus logos, right? Short speech. So like in newspaper articles, titles you usually use, or you know, use those kind of like brachylogy, or in Twitter messages, you don't use conjunctives, you don't use ands, offs, ifs, thens, etc., or nots, etc. But we somehow know how to read it, and it's very interesting for me to think about how to do philosophy as a brachylogy, which doesn't necessarily has to do for me with length. For me, it has to do with precisely this ability to to have those rungs that are not necessarily related to the two sidebars of the ladder in which we ascend or descend, which is kind of like a Wittgenstein metaphor that I can't get rid of, I guess, the ladder. There is no argumentative apparatus in which we can go up and down, in a way. But we need to make, in a way, those connections between all those different vignettes, as I said, that compose. But specifically, these are certain types of books that you write. You also write those kind of like more boring scholarly works that we need to handle. which are different, and they are actually linear in some way. Okay, that, you know, that scholar said this and that scholar said that, and it's kind of linear, and he will take you with like the power and the glory through the entire history of, you know, medieval popes, whatever they said, and it's boring and it's long, but it's actually linear rather than a vignette-like type of a work. So he has these two ways of doing things, I feel, a lot of times.
I want to ask a little bit about the prophecy stuff.
Please.
And specifically about, like, thinking about prophecy in relation to temporality and perhaps maybe the difference between the prophetic and the making, the creative, and so on. So, for instance, like, you draw this distinction between Heidegger and the Napoleon, the way in which, well, whatever, but in a sense they're the same, right? Because the process that matters, however one wants to describe that, begins with the breaking, right? So, for Heidegger, this is an intellectual process. For the Napolitan, this is a creative process, a use, whatever. But the point is that something must break in order to begin, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and to me, this is like a very Christian temporality, right? Felix Culpa, like, happy fall. Like, it is good that things sin so that the time of redemption can begin. Mm-hmm. And then what that does is it creates the future as the time of redemption, the time of healing, the time of putting back together, that somehow is sort of, I don't know, sort of already established and yet still to come, and you're sort of in that space. Uh-huh. The prophetic, on the other hand, right? I mean, what's interesting, I mean, in Christianity there's no prophets anymore. There can't be prophets, right? And I think, if I remember correctly, in... I may be wrong about this, but the time that remains, right, he makes this point, I think, quite clearly, yeah. Right?
Also in Judaism and also in Islam, I mean, he's the last prophet, Muhammad.
Yes, but
so it's the seal of prophecy.
Yeah, but there's a big difference there. Mm-hmm. Because there's a difference between the last prophet, who is the first or the last or the supreme amongst equals, mm-hmm. and the notion of, let's say, Christ, who is a mediator who fulfills all the prophets, and we are done with the time of prophecy because, right. In a sense, we are at the end of time, or we're at the end of... We're no longer in a temporality that you would have if you were to give or receive a prophecy.
There's no need, right.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at, without going on too long, is just that the time of prophecy is quite different. Right, the time of prophecy is quite different. I mean, and one could argue, I think I would agree with this, right, that Islam is more or less historically rebuked to Christianity. Like, you made a mistake. We're still in the time of prophecy, you know, we should not live in this temporality of making, healing, etc. So I guess what I'm wondering is, do you see there being any, if the prophetic is located with the philosophical here, do you see the prophetic as offering any sort of rebuke or tension with this notion of making, right? Particularly, I mean, to push this notion of prophecy a little more, particularly in an Islamic sense, right, is oneness. Like, oneness, 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 all oneness. Which is, my point here is that that's very different from the thematics of broken, fragmentary, collecting, bricolage, putting together, etc., etc., etc. So I'm does this have any play in the way that you think about this, or would this have any play for how we think of art? I don't know. I mean, is this a rebuke to the whole discourse of the end and the future of art, etc.?
Well, I don't think that in any way we have a temporality in which we can say, you know, things were breaking or got broken so far, and now we come and mend them forever and ever, hallelujah, right? That's not a temporality that we can handle. It's too simplistic, it's too before and after, right? But I mean, there are things in the world. People create, do, live, fuck up, right? So then within that, essentially, time that remains, maybe, in a time that really is not temporal, there is no really a before and after, and there is no parousia, there is no end to that mending, as much as there is no end to that breaking. I agree with you about that.
Can I just
yes, please.
Yeah, my point isn't so much about whether the mending comes to an end or not, but the point is that you're in a temporality of mending, because you begin with things being broken, disparate, etc., as you put it, there are things in the world. So isn't the point of prophecy coming first, that before there are things in the world, there is the prophetic? And that's
right, that's what,
I
what, yeah. What the...
So in that sense, the prophet would be saying there are no things in the world. Not yet.
But there will be, and there will break, and someone will need to deal with that. And so that is a demand that comes even before. But again, this is an interesting point. I don't know exactly what to make of it. I'm not sure where we're going. Let me think about it.
Can you talk about it in relation to obligation or obligation to truth? Like,
never.
Like,
we have no obligations. This is not...
No, the prophet's obligation to truth, or the artist's obligation to truth, or the teacher or the wise man.
Right,
all
the different types
figures
of truth, truth-telling, right, in Foucault. We have these different types, and the prophet is one of the four, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I wonder where you imagine the artist is situated in relation to truth.
I mean, again, we can make the truth.
In comparison to that.
We can make the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I'm an artist and I make a piece of art, I essentially make the truth. I'm not in any way... This is not mimesis, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not... The truth doesn't come because I, you know, correspond to something in reality that is, and I made the perfect copy of it. I mean, this is a strange way of thinking about truth from an artistic perspective. We created truth. So also to go back to what you said, I mean, there is those processes in the world in which we create and we save, and this is a daily, everyday practice in which people make and people... Because again, the thing for Agamben is that if you make something and there is no attempt or there is no demand or, that sort of like... command also that one needs to save, but save not in the sense of, you know, when a critic writes a criticism of a work of art, for Benjamin basically, you say the work, you make it real, you complete it, okay? The critic says to the artist, I complete you, basically, in a way. I mean, this is a very strange kind of like extremely powerful thing that Benjamin says. For him, you know, the same way that he will talk about the translator in a similar way. I mean, the task of the saver is, I mean, without the saver, the work is just, I mean, I don't know what one will make out of it as far as, you know, again, structuralist notions of man and woman or whatever. I don't want to get into this. We could, if someone wants to. But my point is that, I mean, there is that incestuous relationship between the two figures that is always there. And it's never in a way coming and going. I mean, we sometimes make, we sometimes save, and in a way, we just need to be aware of each other's existence and play with one another all the time also.
I think the thing that was nice, like what Hallie's triggering is something we were listening to recently, where Foucault is describing this idea of the parousia. And it was interesting to hear, because maybe... thinking about what Agamben does, he situates himself a little bit more in the position of the parousiast. So in terms of the different positions of truth-telling that Foucault describes, there in ancient Greek what was the first one? We were talking about the prophet. There's the prophet, who we've already discussed what the prophet is doing. Usually they're telling a truth of something beyond that they're them speaking on behalf of. So speaking the truth of something that is not present.
Yeah, the authority comes from that. Yeah.
And so they're a mouthpiece. Then the wise man, who usually doesn't speak, because they really kind of speak from a position of
experience, but for the most part, they can see that perhaps what they say isn't really going to change the course of matters. Then there's the teacher. The wise man then has an opinion that he doesn't speak. It's sort of more the important part, the opinion that they don't speak. Teacher is usually educating people on something that actually everyone already knows. It's a knowledge that's being exchanged. And then the Parisiast is sort of the last one, right. And it's the opinion that is terribly unpopular. It's his opinion, but it's what they see as something that absolutely needs to be said because there's right. some kind of imbalance of power or some... it goes against the popular opinion in terms of the demos.
And a lot of time when you read prophecy in the Bible, in the Old Testament, they do actually precisely that. They're,
mm-hmm.
This is Pharisee, basically, more or less.
Yes.
And they get really punished for it and they don't want to speak. And, you know, God insists that they speak and they do it and they know that no one will like them and they're not going to be the popular kids at school.
Yep.
And they still do it and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Right. And
it's much more earthly. This is the reason why I wanted to bring it out.
Right.
It sounded like we were getting kind of abstract, but
right.
but the Parisius is really, you know, trying to return things back to, you know, it is somewhat practical matters, which...
But you brought up the critic, who is...
Yeah, the critic is sort of...
In a Parisius.
Yeah, but the critic is in relationship to the work, to the creation, where I think that maybe, you know, Pharisea is in a way also a way of breaking. Because you have a certain sense, a certain hegemonic sense of what is at stake, what is happening, what
yeah.
is the case. And you have those figures who will break this down somehow and will make you feel uncomfortable about your own situation, about your own life. And it's not Foucault says...
Well, it's supposed to be their life that's at stake. I forgot to put that.
It
is the Parisiast, when they say their truth, their opinion... They could go to jail
right.
or prison or no longer
and
friends.
Also they don't have a dogma. The thing about Pharisee is that you don't have necessarily a philosophy, but your very life and your very actions become precisely that, you know, essentially enacting
yeah.
of a way of thinking. But it's not that, you know, one needs to be X, Y, Z and then you're a good Kantian. You can't do it with, you know...
You probably can be a good Kantian, though, just to throw that in there.
Who can?
Anyone can. You just follow the recipe.
Right. and in a way, I think that, you know, artists can do that precisely. To say that unconventional or inconvenient truth in a way. Sure.
But they have a special place to do that, and that's kind of a case of impunity. So maybe they don't really do that.
Right. Art is what you can get away with. So you can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, as Wall said.
That was a really interesting. There's another
true.
Guest coming in. Johanna Warshaw is coming in June. She's a curator and she was speaking in something when I was doing research on her work, but it was exactly a lot of the aspects of the Berlin Biennale which got really posed a lot of polemics for the art community here. A lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff is super fascinating because it was basically like lawyers trying to legitimize the practice of, say, Voynia, who they acknowledge was not like really artists, this collective in St. Petersburg who does these gestures against the Putin regime and so on, but that by inviting them as curators, it would somehow like allow the legitimacy for these actions to be to nonetheless proliferate, but to be read in within another framework. So it's a really interesting, when you talk about impunity, it's like, can we also mobilize that to our own advantage somehow? I mean, without just saying like, okay, well, I'll just do whatever, but can it be also a strategy?
This impunity is not everywhere granted to the same extent also.
Yeah.
That's what we've seen in Russia.
Yeah, yeah.
And also one of the points that Ayaman makes in that book, The Man Without Content, is that why would Socrates, why would Plato ban the poets from the city? Why art was so dangerous? Why was it some... I mean, we read it as good liberals and we are like, oh, this is censorship. But what, in a way, Agamben is saying is that, you know, if we don't censor anything, then that work is powerless. It's only interesting. But it doesn't really have the power that... I mean, the thing for Plato is that poetry could really shake the establishment. So by banning it, he was really trying to oppose something that is powerful. So in a way, without, you know, Russian or Chinese or whatever kind of censorship, I mean, one can wonder whether art could have any power whatsoever. Because, again, this is just interesting. You just look at it and it's interesting and it could be very subversive. But it's still just interesting. There's no place in the society as a kind of a parousia that one will really want to ban in some way or another. But this is, again, art that is not aesthesis, that is not aesthetics at all. And I think it still happens from time to time, even in our you know, super permissive society, and that's always fun to see.
I have a question. If you would not mind to go back to like the very beginning of your talk, and you repeatedly talked about the working class in relation to salvation, and I can't remember exactly how you phrase it, but if you just want to go back there and go over that, these connections that you were making.
I was just trying to say that the opposite of the working class is not the creative class, but rather that thing that I just invented, which is called the saving class. And then the question is what exactly it is and who are the people that actually could call themselves savers. Okay. And actually the kind of images that I have in mind are actually, you know, like people that clean your office or people that, you know, take care of the mess that you make. Because we make mess. Okay, and who takes care of that? Okay, so for me these are like the most kind of like paradigmatic images of people that save or like that organize again that mess or that you know, wipe the things that we break. It's very nice to break and it's fun, but someone plants those bars that people break when I ride my bike in Berlin, right? So I mean, but who does that work and who does that mending? Okay. Yeah, it's not saving in the sense that now everything is fine and we can go on, but I mean that there is that incessant breakage in our society, and I'm not trying to get rid of it, but I'm just saying there is another class that is, we call it the service class, I guess, in a way, that takes care of, you know, our consumption and our making and our creativity, etc. And that's something else that we usually don't notice, and I think that there is something that has to do with precisely that question of redemption versus salvation, creation versus salvation. Yeah. You make something, and then what? It's very nice to make stuff, right? But then what? What is done with that object, with that writing? It's just standing there. So it has exhibition value, and then people watch it, and then people buy it, and then it just becomes a part of that.
Well,
that exchange.
If it even gets there.
Right.
Right. Is another thing that doesn't just sort of happen magically on its own, I think.
Yeah, but again, the point is that even if it does, then we're lost anyhow, so it doesn't really matter. The question is whether there is another strategy that has to do with redeeming rather than with consuming, perhaps.
But again, doesn't that assume that this is the end then? That's it's now, it has exhibition value, so it's over. But that would go against the way that you're describing. Again, it's methodology where we could look at the work of art and see how it works, not go,
walk
okay, it has exhibition value, so it's over. It's
walk in the sense that I can make use of it in my own work.
Mm-hmm.
But can that making use be like, because we're using very material things, I mean, or textual fragments that you were saying, like the tools
right.
of the writer, can that also not be an affective impulse? Like what I look at this euro, you know, I'm not going to actually physically take this off the wall and turn it into my own installation.
Right.
I'm going to be affected by it, and
right.
that will perhaps transform a process
and maybe
in
that's
my own. I mean, what I'm just trying to understand the threshold of this.
Yeah, maybe that has to do with precisely that question of, you know, the formal rather than the content of the work. What does that have to do with the way we can, yeah that can resonate in between different works.
Mm.
Maybe that speaks to that, but maybe not.
Mm.
I mean, yeah.
I'm not sure how to put this question, but you talked a bit about method, which I just think is something that I'm trying to think about. And I know we're not trying to divide the work of art necessarily from the philosophizing about it, but I don't know if the other artists in the room think about method. Like, since I've been in an institution, there's a certain pressure sometimes to articulate your method.
Right.
So even when you would describe Du Bois's method as that's so interesting. I think, oh, you know, I always think, oh, I'd be missing out on this method thing, and I'd be so I'm trying to think whether you could create a work of art that just is a method, and that maybe it's a little bit like what conceptual art was in a way. It was like a method, and also this is a side thought because I'm wondering why do I want to have this method? I think maybe it's because I'm downloading all these apps. Apps are kind of like the methods of some little thing that they just do something. So anyways, this question about method, I just feel like anything else to say about method and whether there's anything interesting in that idea about work of art that's just a method.
Mm.
Or is it all always happening and I'm sort of the gap down and everybody has a method?
Yeah. Well, I think that, I mean, first and foremost, method always comes after. It's not a priori. Method is always a posteriori. Like one of the last things Agamben wrote is a book called The Signature of Things, or The Signature of All Things, which I think is a better title. But the thing is that he will say at the first line or the second line something like, you know, method is something that comes after you already establish it. And then it's really kind of like a conversation between friends rather than something that can be imposed. So that had something to do with my attempt to talk about isms and schools and the fact that he never really falls to this trap. Now, I'm not sure that when you talk about conceptual art and you talk about, let's say Trisha Brown, when she does her early pieces, so she will have a certain kind of a machine that then she will... that the dancers will enact, okay? You just need to have the stick attached to it, the other guy's stick, etc., and make a big stick out of it, okay? So there is essentially, it's not exactly a method as much as it is a, what's the word I'm looking for, an instruction, or a task.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that with conceptual art, you know, for instance, you can get the whole book of all Solowitz, you know, little drawings on the wall, and then you can do it yourself, right? In a way. And then the actual making of the art is a perfunctory affair, right? It comes, I mean, you don't even necessarily need to do it. But I think that the task is different than the method, though.
Yeah.
Right?
The task is different than the method.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the task?
A task is stand up, sit down, do this.
Oh, yeah, like in Trisha Brown.
Right, but I mean, a lot of those, you know, conceptual art will be based on that. So the making of the actual work is basically based on a blueprint. But again, a blueprint is not necessarily the method. I think that
the idea that in a conceptual art, you could, like, I just used it as an example of a moment where you could think that if you believe the kind of really conventional way to describe the move to conceptualism or the, like, you know, art as idea, it's already a kind of. Is it? I don't know. I was thinking not so much about task-based or instruction-based, but.
But an artist and a philosopher, both of them can have a method. Okay, this is not something that is. So a method is not an idea, again, because that will be a content already.
Right.
You know, it's like the thing that I make, as an artist. You know, the object that this is a thing. This is not the idea, and the method is again a different thing altogether.
But I think your idea to bring in the app was actually quite good because that exemplifies it in a way. Because if you imagine how you would produce maybe an app, it's like there's a task that you would have to perform over and over. And at some point, if you're good at programming, you would say, I'm going to make an app that will do that for me. That then becomes a method potentially, like if you take this over into a process, which... is not no longer, I would say, then the task. It's performing the task. The method is performing the task. So it's at a kind of a meta level. And I think in that respect, you were talking about conceptual art as individual conceptual art works, whereas I think you were thinking about conceptual art as an approach.
And also almost as a way to escape the, you know, escape the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just the revolution must have this idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a false move, obviously.
It was a philosophy.
It was a false move, basically.
A false move.
Like we all learned it was a fake. Yeah.
It's kind of fake. Right?
We thought, oh, we're just
well,
going to save us.
Maybe
just,
it's
no,
a good,
it's
maybe
another
it's
problem.
A good app.
Yeah.
The conceptual
art. Correct. Conceptual art.
You could
algorithm
it.
Yeah.
I just picked it up on the Chinese thing. I thought that was really interesting what you were saying about the resistance. Like, stuff was banned in Russia, stuff was banned in China. Like, Zhu Bing did that huge set of dragons for this big public art, public building in downtown Beijing. Somehow it just was poetic, but it was too easy to see it as criticism. It's the huge 100-foot, two pair of dragons, young female dragons made of shovels from workers from the building and so on. And it's been, now it's at Mass MoCA. And it's celebrated in the West as a kind of amazing, huge thing. And doing guest teaching in Beijing over the last 3 years, we're instructed very clearly in these end-of-year events to say, not to the student, like, what's this work about? Or, why did you make this work? We're forbidden to sort of go there. It's, you begin the question with, how did you make this work?
Mm-hmm.
And out of that spills the student's ability to describe the work or their concerns or something, but it's very... it's very useful, actually, to avoid our normal Western way of approaching, which would be those other two questions pretty fast.
Right.
And you get to, I think, you know, what is the task, what is the method, what is the material, and underneath all that is what is the resistance. Like, it's so powerful. China celebrates contemporary art as a symbol that China's free. And it allows a certain amount of contemporary art to make sure everyone knows that they're free and that they can contribute to the world in that kind of way. And then as soon as they do something that has a double meaning, which most art does,
mm-hmm.
most art can be read on multiple levels, and that often gives it its charge, then it seems then it may be subversive.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, and then it can't kind of move right now particularly. And if your computer has the word art in it, even in the tagline, or you work for an art school or anything, your work, all of your images and emails will be censored from the minute you're on the radar of the government. And they'll even send a broken robot to your screen. It'll open your Mac, and instead of getting your Gmail, whatever, Gmail's banned, YouTube is banned, people use IPNs to get these kind of things. But the fact that the Chinese government shows you this broken robot is very interesting, because the U.S. government can read all your email as well, but they don't tell you that they want you to understand this tension. But this tension creates incredibly interesting work now in both Russia and China, I think.
I just want to say last about that is that the last chapter in the Common Community is called Tiananmen, in which Agamben is trying to talk about what was it exactly that the Tiananmen Square events were about, and the point that he's trying to make is that they weren't about a specific thing. They weren't about, we want to be like the West, we want to be free, and we want to have democracy. Obviously, that was not the case. And the point is that actually, when you don't say what it is about, the protest or the art, that's actually something that, from this, the position of a sovereign state, is the most difficult to digest. Because they want to put you in some... I mean, if you say that you're against X, that would be better for you to say that you're basically doing this whatever, what the Agamben would call whateverness, whatever that may be, without precisely putting yourself in that specific, you know, this is what we stand for, that's what we want, which was, again, the problem with Wall Street, etc. Occupy, that is. So, in a way, maybe, when we don't say what the art is about, when it's not about, you know, how the shovels become the dragon and blah, 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 when it's actually abstract in a level of, you know, pure movement, when it's in the level of when you cannot pin it down, it's actually the most subversive in some weird way. Maybe.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, David, for your time. And
thank you
for coming out.
Yeah. I met you at the
Aliasin or something.
Yeah.
Nice.
Did you find it? Oh, yeah.